Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, October 27, 2023. Congressman Dean Phillips of Minnesota announces he is running for president, challenging incumbent President Joe Biden for the Democratic nomination. Dean Phillips filed his paperwork in Concord, New Hampshire today to get on the state ballot. He says he is the only candidate who can beat the likely Republican Party nominee, former President Donald Trump. Dean Phillips says, "I think President Biden has done a spectacular job for our country, but it's not about the past. This is an election about the future. I will not sit still. I will not be quiet in the face of numbers that are so clearly saying that we're going to be facing an emergency next November." The U.S. launches airstrikes against militant groups in Syria backed by Iran in response to those groups attacking and wounding U.S. troops in the region. We'll hear from White House National Security spokesperson John Kirby. The new U.S. House Speaker, Mike Johnson, Republican, talks about splitting President Biden's request for aid for Israel and Ukraine so that each is voted on separately. And former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, a Democrat, reveals what she told the new Speaker, Mike Johnson, right after his re-election. Associated Press in Concord, New Hampshire, reporting for months, Dean Phillips has been calling for a Democratic primary challenge to President Joe Biden. He's drawn no public interest from governors, lawmakers, and other would-be alternatives. The 54-year-old Minnesota congressman is finally entering the race himself, telling a Friday event outside New Hampshire State House, "I am today announcing my candidacy for presidency of the United States." Dean Phillips, one of Congress's wealthiest members, has been effusive in his praise for Joe Biden, but also says their party needs younger voices to avoid a nightmare scenario where Donald Trump is reelected next fall. That was from Associated Press. Well, Dean Phillips did file his paperwork at the State House in Concord, New Hampshire, on this last day to qualify for the ballot, and then held a rally outside.
"We fund more for fighting than we do for feeding. Corporations and the well-off, including me, enjoy more favorable tax treatment than hard-working American families. Too many of our children are hungry, and too many of our veterans are homeless. Anger and violence are rising, and our life expectancy is falling. Gun violence ravaging our communities, including right next door in Maine. 18 American lives claimed by yet another massacre. That is why I'm running for president of the United States of America, because we cannot tolerate it any longer. Any longer. And I call on gun owners, I call on activists, I call on the exhausted majority to come together and save American lives. America has no health care system, only sick care. And that care is more expensive right here in America than it is anywhere else in the entire world. We have no mental health care system here, only a system of greed and corruption. Chaos at our border and in our cities is growing, while our commitment to countering it is receding. Prices are way too high, medicines way too expensive, and diseases of despair are claiming our children through addiction and suicide. We spend billions and billions sending our soldiers to foreign lands, and still, we have not fixed the failures in Flint, Americans have been so busy fighting one another that we have ceased fighting our greatest challenges. So come on, America. I say, come on, America. We are better. I know we are better, so let's do better. It is time. It is time, my friends. It is time for we, the exhausted majority, to meet this moment. We will stand in the way of extremists who are hijacking America and large swaths of the entire world. We will lead America back to its rightful and righteous place, both here at home and abroad. And we, the new generation, we will rise not through war but through peace, and not just here, but throughout the entire world. These are the issues of the 2024 presidential election in the United States. And let me tell you, America, I am ready to get to work. We will replace darkness with light. We will replace fear with optimism and poverty with prosperity. Among you, the great people of the state of New Hampshire, who have been the very first to vet presidential candidates just like me for over 100 years, and whose motto, live free or die, speaks for every single American. I invite you to join me in declaring a new American independence, not from another nation or people, rather a new independence from fear and from the status quo. That road to a new American century starts right here, and it starts right now. I am running for the Democratic nomination for President of the United States because, my friends, it is time for a change, and I am ready to lead our great nation to a secure and a more prosperous future. I do so not in opposition to President Biden, who has my affection and my gratitude, rather with two core convictions: that I am the Democratic candidate who can win the 2024 election. And second, it is time for the torch to be passed to a new generation of American leaders, right here, all around the country, and all around the world.
Democratic presidential candidate Congressman Dean Phillips of Minnesota in Concord, New Hampshire today. Politico's congressional correspondent Nicholas Wu has been following all this, joins us now live by phone. Thanks for being with us. A lot of headlines about this candidacy using the words long shot. Is that fair?
That's a very fair assessment of Mr. Phillips, since this campaign, in some ways, it's not really starting as a serious effort to win delegates. Because of the way Democrats moved around their primary calendar in New Hampshire, regardless of where Congressman Phillips places in New Hampshire, he won't be winning delegates out of this. But the point, I think, that he has been stressing all along is that he wants to try to force a debate within the Democratic Party about passing the torch and about the ability of President Joe Biden to win the general election. And whether that means Phillips himself ends up becoming the nominee or not remains to be seen. It's unlikely, but at the very least, he wants to force a conversation.
What has been the reaction from the Democratic establishment to that approach?
It's kind of run the gamut from a lot of shrugs and raised eyebrows to almost bewilderment in other corners of the party. I think there is certainly some private concern that Democrats have expressed about what this could mean for damaging Biden's chances in the general election, especially since Phillips has made Biden's age and faculties a part of his campaign. At the same time, Democratic leadership that I've talked to has largely batted aside any concerns about this run. When the number three House Democrat, Pete Aguilar, was asked about this a couple days ago, he said that it was par for the course in the House of Representatives for people to have ambitions to run for other things. And so, at least now, publicly, they're not sweating it.
Now, President Biden is not going to be on the New Hampshire ballot. You mentioned, and you can explain why, but there is talk of a write-in campaign. So, in the end, how will the results be interpreted?
So, no matter how this shakes out, neither Biden nor Phillips or anyone else on the Democratic side of the first-in-the-nation primary ballot in New Hampshire is going to be winning Democratic delegates because of the way Democrats have changed their rules this year to put South Carolina first. But the way that Phillips' campaign is seeing it is that if they can make a strong enough showing in New Hampshire or even show that they're winning it, this could give them momentum to win or to really put a serious dent in Biden's vote share in other states. It kind of remains to be seen. I mean, some of the early pictures we're seeing coming out of the his campaign launch in New Hampshire showed more reporters there than Phillips supporters and you know, some manner of technical mishaps. But, you know, I think there's certainly public polling showing that there's some softness in Biden's position in the Democratic Party, and this could put a dent in it.
We're talking with Nicholas Wu from Politico. Dean Phillips has been talking about a challenge for a while, but he was saying he would rather somebody else do it. And when no one else stepped up, now he's done it. How serious was he trying to recruit somebody?
He'd been very publicly calling for the last few months for a primary challenger against Biden, whether it was a governor or any other number of different younger Democrats in the party, since Congressman Phillips had been vocal for quite a while about a need for generational change. He staked out a position pretty early in the party, for example, in calling for Senator Feinstein to step down when some of her health issues flared up. And, you know, he's openly talked about not wanting Biden to run again either. And so it remains to be seen, you know, how exactly this is going to play out in this primary challenge.
And finally, do you know which state will have Dean Phillips and Joe Biden on the ballot getting delegates, the first head-to-head matchup?
We don't know yet, since he hasn't filed yet to get himself on the ballot in other states. New Hampshire, he missed the deadline already for Nevada, which would be one of the other early states. And today, Friday, is the last day that he could have filed for New Hampshire. And so, you know, a test of how serious this bid is really going to be is whether Congressman Phillips ends up filing for any of the other early states like South Carolina to see if he'll actually get himself on the ballot there and if we'll see a real head-to-head matchup between him and Biden for delegates and whether that could matter.
Nicholas Wu, Politico's congressional correspondent. His stories at Politico.com and on X, formerly Twitter, at Nicholas Wu 12. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
And again, from the Associated Press article covering Dean Phillips' announcement in New Hampshire, Kevin Munoz, they write, a spokesman for Biden's reelection campaign to the president, is proud of the historic unified support he has from across the Democratic Party for his reelection. The stakes of next year's election could not be higher for the American people, and the campaign is hard at work mobilizing the winning coalition that President Biden can uniquely bring together to once again beat the MAGA Republicans next November. A quote from campaign spokesperson Kevin Munoz, MAGA, referring to Donald Trump's Make America Great Again movement. And WMUR-TV in New Hampshire, talking about Joe Biden not being on the New Hampshire primary ballot, writing the move was not unexpected because of the Democratic National Party's attempts to get New Hampshire to relinquish its first-in-the-nation status. Ray Buckley, New Hampshire Democratic Party chair, said, well, it certainly was expected, and that's why a group of prominent Democrats across the state are organizing a write-in. And even with the incumbent's name absent, Buckley said the write-in campaign will be enough to deliver Joe Biden the win in New Hampshire. Former U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr, who served under Presidents Donald Trump and George H.W. Bush, talked about his view of the state of the 2024 presidential election and the possible rematch between President Biden and former President Trump. Bill Barr was in conversation Thursday night at the University of Chicago Institute of Politics.
The polls show it's, you know, a pretty tight race right now for 2024. What is your biggest concern about a Trump presidency in 2024?
Well, I have concerns about a Biden presidency, too.
That was not my question.
I don't want to be faced with the choice between those two individuals.
Well, I think that I think America would agree with you on
yeah,
that. The polls
but as
show
to
that
Trump,
too.
You know, my you know, one of my one of the reasons I'm so frustrated about Trump is because I believe, left to their own devices and with a quasi-normal Republican conservative candidate, the country would elect a center-right government by a large margin, with both the House and Senate going Republican. And and if you look at all the battlegrounds, all the key states, Florida and Georgia, Virginia, you have conservative governors who are racking up big margins. And why isn't that happening on the national level? I think it's because of Donald Trump, and the polls show that. I mean, you know, the independent, a lot of people have left the Republican Party from the suburbs and become independents, and he's not picking those people back up. So it'll be a tight race, probably, but Biden is making it much easier for him to win if he's the nominee, with the incompetence of his administration, in my opinion.
But let me just stop there, because I just find myself thinking, really? I mean, we're really talking about Trump 2024, after January 6th, you could go through other things, but I mean, how is that not disqualifying?
Pinch me. I'm stunned by it, but what's happening is that a lot of the voters, conservative voters, a lot of working class voters who have recently come into the Republican Party, are very angry. They're angry and frustrated, and I think this is reflected in their attitude, which is sort of the hell with you all. You know, we need someone to really shake up the system, and so they don't. Many of them are not listening to reason, and they're not interested in, you know, what it would actually take to win the kind of victory that it could allow you to install your policies.
What do you think Trump would be like as president if he wins in 24?
Well, he's already saying it's going to be about retribution, and he's a very petty man, and it's all about him. He has a very fragile ego, and you know, something happened to him as a kid, and I'm not going to spend time psychoanalyzing it, but you know, every encounter he has to come out showing the other guy that he's better. It's all about, you know, the assertion of his ego, and I think he will be self-indulgent in a new administration, and you know, won't be as effective as he could otherwise be, and probably things would start moving toward chaos.
Yeah.
Former Attorney General Bill Barr, who served under President Donald Trump and George H.W. Bush, speaking with CBS News Chief Legal Correspondent Jan Crawford at the University of Chicago Institute of Politics Thursday night. One major focus of President Biden's reelection campaign has been his economic agenda that he calls Bidenomics. And Lael Brainard, chair of the White House National Economic Council, spoke today at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. After her presentation that she says shows the strength of the U.S. economy, she took audience questions, and one asked why the American people, according to polls, don't necessarily see it that way.
Alan Blinder, Princeton and Peterson.
Thank you.
Thanks. I'd like to take you back to what you spoke about, which was a very impressive litany of adding up to a big success story compared to other nations, compared to previous expectations, and really has put the United States economy in a pretty good position. Yet, as you well know, the American people tell pollsters they're sour about the economy, and they're particularly sour about President Biden's performance as the leader. I get asked about this all the time, and I've ruminated about it, and so have lots of people, but I'd like to know what you think about is behind that disjuncture.
Yeah. So I am just struck by how traumatic the pandemic years, and there were years, were for households here in America. And I think it takes some time for people following that kind of really unprecedented set of dislocations to work, to school, to their ability to just carry on routines. It takes a while to feel more secure. And so I think, you know, this just takes a while. Now, if you look at how people respond in surveys. I think it's 70% of the American people say that their personal finances are good and have improved, but they don't connect the dots, or many of those. We don't get the same strong numbers when it comes to the overall economy. Similarly, when you poll the policies that the president has enacted, they're enormously popular policies. So you get really good responses on them, including, by the way, Americans really do support paying for things by raising taxes on wealthier people and, you know, by corporations that aren't actually paying as much tax as we expect in terms of our corporate tax rate. So those are things that are well supported. But you're right, in terms of seeing the connection between those, it's going to take a while.
Lael Brainard chairs the White House National Economic Council, speaking today at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. The Commerce Department says an inflation measure watched closely by the Federal Reserve when it's determining what to do with interest rates rose in September. The core personal consumption expenditures, or PCE price index, rose 0.3% in September, 3.7% annual rate, down from 3.9% in August. The Fed meets next week to discuss further interest rate possible hikes. Wall Street today, the Dow down 366, NASDAQ up 47, S&P down 19. Congress is not in session today. It follows an eventful week in the U.S. House with the election of a new speaker, Republican Mike Johnson of Louisiana. And that ends a three-week search that saw three other Republican candidates nominated and then dropping out because they did not have enough votes to be elected in the full House. Thursday night, former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Democrat from California, talked about what she told Speaker Johnson after he was elected.
I'll just share one thing that I shared with the new speaker yesterday as I congratulated him. I said, I noticed that you mentioned Ronald Reagan in your comments. It's interesting. I said, but I want to make sure that you, a speech that I quote probably more than any other president is Ronald Reagan. Would you imagine? You heard me say Teddy Roosevelt and Ronald Reagan, Abraham Lincoln, three Republicans. I only mentioned Joe once. So I said, you have to read Ronald Reagan, and I promise you this will be the end. Ronald Reagan said this, and you Google it because it's much better said by him, the great communicator than me. He said this is the last speech I will make as President of the United States, and I want to communicate a message to a country I love. He goes on longer to talk about the Statue of Liberty and the beacon of hope it is to the world. And he talks about how America is preeminent in the world because America's door has always been open. And if we choose to close the door, he has a lot more in there. We're invigorated by all these newcomers and ideas, and this is America, a nation of immigrants. And then it's, but if we choose to close that door, we will end being the preeminent nation in the world. But you have to read the whole speech and recognize that this is Ronald Reagan making that speech. Now, we do are a nation of immigrants, and that constant reinvigoration has been a wonderful thing for our country. We have our challenges that we have to secure our border and this or that, but never forget who we are. Maybe you're blessed to be a Native American, and God bless you for that. That's a blessing to our country. But also that this is a country unlike any other that was founded on a principle of equality that was just grown, developed, inspired, invigorated by newcomers coming to our country, and how we deal with the future in that regard. So very important.
Speaker Emerita Nancy Pelosi, Democrat from California, Thursday night at Georgetown University. In the audience were first-year law students. Nancy Pelosi was House Speaker from 2007 through 2011 and then again from 2019 to 2023. Republican Congressman Chip Roy of Texas also reflected Thursday night about the drawn-out search for a new House Speaker, and he, too, highlighted the issue of immigration and border security. Congressman Roy spoke on the House floor.
One of the things that I think is really important that I've observed throughout this process, as I sit here in a largely empty chamber with two members of Congress, a lot of my colleagues, you know, are catching their flights home after a few weeks of drama surrounding the speaker. One of the things that I've observed in this debate about who should be the speaker and what House Republicans want to do with the majority is that my Democrat colleagues are nowhere to be found on any of the issues that matter to the people I represent and the vast majority of the American people. That is the simple truth. With all due respect to my Democrat colleagues, some of whom I consider friends that I've worked to move legislation with, happy to have debates with, they are utterly missing in action when it comes to anything that matters to the people that I represent. $33.5 trillion in debt, $2 trillion a year in deficit spending, and my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, and frankly, a decent number of my own colleagues on this side of the aisle, are completely missing in action when it comes to figuring out how to stop spending money we don't have. When it comes to open borders, my colleagues on the other side of the aisle not only won't sit down to figure out solutions, they're actively working to thwart any possible path to doing what we need to do to secure the border of the United States. And the American people, particularly the Texans that I represent, are looking with abject horror on the utter and complete failure that is this body and the Senate and the White House's response to wide open borders. And in fact, their active engagement in creating the environment where our borders can be exploited.
Congressman Chip Roy, Republican from Texas, on the House floor Thursday night. Again, the House and the Senate not in session this Friday. The House is back on Monday at noon Eastern. Several bills on the schedule, including declaring a nuclear ban as unacceptable, urging the European Union to designate Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, preventing international financing for Hamas, the SHIP Act, Stop Harboring Iranian Petroleum, it stands for, and another bill condemning the support of Hamas, Hezbollah, and other terror organizations and institutions of higher education. The Senate returns at 3 p.m. Eastern on Monday, October 30th, and there's one roll call expected at this point, 5:30 p.m. Eastern. Motion to invoke cloture on the nomination of Matthew Maddox to be U.S. District Judge for the District of Maryland. As always, the House is live on C-SPAN television, the Senate live on C-SPAN 2, gavel to gavel. Washington Today continues in a moment.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
When citizens are truly informed, our republic thrives. Get informed straight from the source on C-SPAN. Unfiltered, unbiased, word for word. From the nation's capital to wherever you are. Because the opinion that matters the most is your own. This is what democracy looks like. C-SPAN, powered by cable.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast wherever you find your podcasts and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app. A few more headlines. A federal judge has set the criminal trial for Congressman George Santos, Republican from New York, to begin September 9th, 2024. George Santos pleaded this morning not guilty to 10 additional charges, alleging he stole campaign donors' identities and racked up thousands of dollars in fraudulent charges on their credit cards, among other offenses. He's also charged with embezzling cash from his company and conspiring with his former campaign treasurer to falsify donation totals in order to hit fundraising targets set by the National Republican Campaign Committee. And former president and presidential candidate Donald Trump set to testify November 6th at his New York civil fraud trial. That will follow testimony from his three older children. And also today, the judge in that case, Arthur Engoron, ruling that his daughter Ivanka Trump must also testify. And the White House is launching a virtual tour of the White House utilizing Google Street View technology. First Lady Jill Biden posting on X, calling all teachers to celebrate National Civics Day. Google for EDU and I are opening the doors of the White House to classrooms across the country. I invite you and your students to take a virtual field trip to learn about our past and present. And the website is whitehouse.gov/virtual-tour. The Pentagon said overnight that U.S. military jets carried out airstrikes in eastern Syria against facilities belonging to Iranian-backed militant groups, believed to be responsible for more than a dozen rocket and drone attacks on U.S. troops in Iraq and Syria that injured 21 service members. This all comes, of course, with the backdrop of the ongoing war between Israel and Hamas, Hamas supported by Iran. John Kirby, a spokesperson for the White House National Security Council, talked about this in a virtual audio news conference.
On the airstrikes, again, I know the Pentagon has already gone through this all with you, but certainly you're all aware about the self-defense airstrikes that we took last night in response to the attacks against U.S. personnel since October 17th. The Central Command and the military are still evaluating the impact of those strikes, but I would just remind you that the purpose for those two sites that we targeted was to have a significant impact on future IRGC and Iran-backed militia group operations. It went right at storage facilities and ammo depots that we know were being used to support the work of these militia groups, and particularly in Syria. And the main goal is to disrupt that ability, also to deter to prevent future attacks. We're not interested, as Secretary Austin said in his statement last night, in escalating this. Nobody's looking for a conflict with Iran. And I want to also be clear that this was, as the Secretary said, completely separate and distinct from what's going on between Israel and Hamas. The President has been crystal clear that he's going to act to protect U.S. personnel on the ground. And we continue to reserve the right to respond to any attacks at a time and a place of our choosing. We will not hesitate to take further actions in our own self-defense.
John Kirby is Strategic Communications Coordinator for the White House National Security Council, holding a online audio news conference. Story from CNN, the Israeli Defense Forces announced Friday they are expanding ground operations in the Gaza Strip, according to an IDF spokesman. Rear Admiral Daniel Hagari. The announcement comes as CNN reports a large series of explosions rocked Gaza City on Friday night. John Kirby was also asked about this.
I just wanted to check in again, if you could give any detail on whether the U.S. was aware of the expanding ground incursion happening today. And at this point, can the U.S. say with confidence that Israel has thought through all the steps of what happens after the ground incursion?
Selena, I'm not going to talk about and get into details of the conversations that we have with our Israeli counterparts and the information flow between us. I think that would be a very imprudent place for me to go. And I'm not going to talk about their decision-making process or, frankly, what's actually unfolding on the ground. They have to speak to that. And they have to be able to answer the questions about the soundness of their planning and the effectiveness of their execution.
John Kirby, Strategic Communications Coordinator for the White House National Security Council. From VOA, the U.S. Treasury Department announced a second round of sanctions Friday on the Palestinian militant group Hamas and Hamas-linked officials in response to its October 7th attack on Israel that killed more than 1,400 people, including women and children. The Treasury Department said in a statement the new sanctions imposed through its Office of Foreign Asset Control target Hamas financial networks, additional assets in Hamas's investment portfolio, and individuals who have facilitated the evasion of previous existing sanctions. And the sanctions include members of Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps and Gaza-based organization that funneled illicit funds from Iran to Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad. That from Voice of America. The White House says that President Biden met Thursday with the new House Speaker, Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, and the House Minority Leader, Hakeem Jeffries, Democrat from New York, to talk about the president's request of $100 billion for aid to Israel, Ukraine, Taiwan, and the U.S.-Mexico border. Speaker Johnson was interviewed Thursday night on Fox News and said he expects aid for Israel and aid for Ukraine to have separate votes in the House.
I told the staff at the White House today that our consensus among House Republicans is that we need to bifurcate those issues. I agree with your assessment in Ukraine, and that's why the American people are demanding some real accountability for the use of those dollars. Now, we can't allow Vladimir Putin to prevail in Ukraine because I don't believe it would stop there, and it would probably encourage and empower China to perhaps make a move on Taiwan. We have these concerns. We're not going to abandon them, but we have a responsibility, a stewardship responsibility, over the precious treasure of the American people. And we have to make sure that the White House is providing the people with some accountability for the dollars. And we want to know what the objective there is. What is the end game in Ukraine? The White House has not provided that. I was at the White House for a couple of hours today, and I told the staff there that this is where we are. This is where the House Republicans are. So we're going to look at Israel separately.
That kind of money, is that America having a proxy war with Putin and Russia?
It's a great concern. We've got a group of our colleagues here in the House, led by Mike Garcia out of California, a brilliant legislator and a top gun pilot. And some of our veterans have gotten together. Dan Crenshaw is involved in this and others. They came up with a document that presents 12 critical questions for the White House to answer as a condition of our supplying the additional support. These are not hard questions, Sean. These are things the White House should be forthcoming about. I delivered that myself.
Oh, you did deliver it to the president?
I delivered it myself today and to the National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan.
Did he read it?
He says he's studying.
He's going to study it tonight during the show.
Yes. So we want to be cooperative. We need to work together on this. But we owe it to the people to know what the plan is, where the money's going to be spent, and we need some auditing for the dollars that we've already sent over there. These are not tough questions, right? Mm-hmm. Israel is a separate matter. We're going to bring forward a standalone Israel funding measure over $14 billion.
Is $14 billion enough?
Israel's requested a little less than that, actually. The White House did, by way of Israel, and $14.5 billion specifically is what we're looking at. It's a very specific number tied to very specific measures. But here's the important thing that distinguishes House Republicans from the other team. We're going to find pay-fors in the budget. We're not just printing money to send it overseas. We're going to find the cuts elsewhere to do that.
House Speaker Mike Johnson interviewed on Fox News Thursday night. This story from The Hill, Senator J.D. Vance, Republican of Ohio, is criticizing newly elected House Speaker Mike Johnson for comments suggesting Johnson could support additional U.S. support for Ukraine. To his credit, the new speaker has been a stalwart on the Ukraine issue, voting consistently against an endless conflict with no plan from the Biden administration, Senator Vance said on X, formerly Twitter. It's concerning to see him change his tune so quickly after being elevated to this role. From Associated Press in Brussels, it was a good thing, they write, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky had his video conference address to the European Union summit pre-slotted for the opening session. Immediately afterward, EU leaders switched off and went to the order of the day, the Israel-Hamas war. They didn't come back to the issue of Russia's war in Ukraine again before Friday's closing day of the summit. After dominating summit after summit since Moscow launched a full-scale invasion of Ukraine on February 24, 2022, Zelensky will now find it challenging to get all the attention and the political, economic, and military aid that Ukraine wants. That from AP. There's also this in the story that may extend beyond Europe, too, since the new U.S. House Speaker Mike Johnson has shown little interest in providing additional money from Congress to support Ukraine. He has said now is the moment we must stand with our important ally in the Middle East, and that's Israel. Well, Ukraine's ambassador to the United States, Oksana Markarova, spoke about this today at a military reporters and editors conference in Washington, D.C., hosted by the Medill School of Journalism.
Jay Price, I'm with the American Homefront Project, which is a collaboration of several local stations and national public radio. Let's circle back to the American political scene. I think it's no secret at all that the last president had an unusual, for American presidents, affinity for the Russian leader. that candidate now for office again has a lot of sway with the House, and one of his colleagues was now made leader of the House. Let's not sugarcoat this. What happens if all of the support goes away? Not just enough to win or keep the grind, the long grind going, but what happens if they pull all of the support?
Well, it's going to be extremely, extremely difficult for us. It's very difficult to guess what will happen, but I can tell you that Ukrainians will keep fighting. And whether it will mean that we will all die fighting, or we will fight successfully, we frankly don't know. But what we know is that we don't have another home, and we don't have another land, and we will fight for this one as long as we will be able to do so. And frankly, that's what Ukrainians did even after the World War II ended, fighting, you know, the Ukrainian freedom fighters were fighting against the Soviets all the way until 1954. Now, the implications of that is going to be much wider than just for Ukraine. If Russia can win after they have violated the UN Charter, after they have violated all the rules which both of our countries believe should be in place, if the authoritarian nuclear state led by a war criminal, indicted war criminal by the international court, can actually win over Ukraine and move forward, then I think the question is not only what Ukrainians would do, but what will all of us do? We just have to be very clear that, yes, it's going to be very difficult. We are, in military sense, 100% dependent on our partners now. Yes, we have started our own production of drones, and Ukraine is one of the fastest top producer of this new capabilities, but we need the air defense, and we need the artillery, and we will try to produce as much as we can. And just recently, we had the big forum between defense industry forum in Ukraine. So we're trying to make partnership, but that will take time. We don't want to be dependent 100% even on our friends and allies. That's why we're putting efforts on restarting our production, starting the new production. But that will take time. That's why this supplementary help now is so important. Now, in addition to that, we do have help from the European countries and from other countries. It's beyond the European Union, that Japan and other countries are helping us as well. So, but without the United States, of course, it's going to be very difficult. It's probably the very diplomatic word that I should use. On the other hand, I'm looking at all the polls, and I'm talking to so many people in the U.S., and I'm talking to both parties, and we still do have the bipartisan support. And I think, you know, whether you look at the Democratic Party ideas and beliefs, or you look at the Reagan doctrine, or you look at what we hear from our Republican friends, if we believe in freedom and democracy, and we believe that we should defend it, then we should do it together while it's still contained in Ukraine.
Ukraine's ambassador to the United States, Oksana Makarova, at the Military Reporters and Editors Conference in Washington, D.C. today, hosted by the Medill School of Journalism. The Pentagon yesterday announced another $150 million in U.S. security assistance for Ukraine. It includes anti-aircraft missiles. And in the announcement, the Pentagon said the United States has committed more than $44.5 billion in security assistance to Ukraine since the beginning of the Biden administration, including $43.9 billion since the war began. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Sign up for C-SPAN's evening newsletter, word for word. It's free. And get the stories making headlines in Washington emailed to you every day. Subscribe at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night and weekend.
C-SPAN's Washington Journal, our live forum involving you to discuss the latest issues in government, politics, and public policy. From Washington and across the country. Coming up Saturday morning.
will look at recent legal challenges to social media companies over claims that the platforms negatively impact youth mental health with Fair Play Executive Director Josh Golan. And for our Spotlight on Podcast segment, we'll speak with James Lindsay, host of The President's Inbox. C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Join in the conversation live at 7 Eastern Saturday morning on C-SPAN, C-SPAN Now, or online at cspan.org.